Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carville. Coming up...
The Director of Public Prosecutions, who directed that no prosecutions were warranted. The investigation did result in disciplinary action against a number of Gardaí.
The Gardaí investigating themselves, a toothless Taoiseach and a confidential recipient that was not fit for purpose.
And are we on the cusp of another property boom? Our late debate after the news from Eileen Whelan.
Good evening. The political crisis in Northern Ireland deepened tonight after the DUP leader, Peter Robinson, met the Secretary of State, Theresa Villiers, at Hillsborough. Mr Robinson said afterwards he had demanded an independent public inquiry into how more than 200 letters were issued by the Northern Ireland office telling the recipients they were not wanted for questioning by the authorities. A letter issued to County Donegal man John Downey led to the collapse of the 1982 Hyde Park bombing trial in London yesterday. The DUP leader said he has given the British government until Friday to provide answers to a series of questions tabled during tonight's meeting. Members of the Public Accounts Committee are to question rehab executives tomorrow about their expenditure. Rehab received €82 million in state payments in 2013. It's understood that committee members have been informed that they must stay within their remit and focus on issues around payments from the HSE, Solus and payments made under the Charitable Lotteries Fund. Police in West Belfast are investigating a shooting incident in the Nor Glen Gardens area of the city. At around 7 o'clock this evening, a man sustained gunshot wounds to both his legs and arms. He was taken to hospital, where it's understood his condition is not life-threatening. There was no winner of tonight's lotto jackpot worth just over €7 million. The numbers drawn were 9, 13, 27, 28, 34 and 39. The bonus number was 40.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Liberty Insurance. Hit the road happy with Great Value Motor Insurance.
Wet and windy weather clearing eastwards tonight. Colder, less windy weather with occasional heavy showers will follow from the west later. Lowest temperatures 2 to 4 degrees. Thursday will be a bright, cool day with sunny spells and scattered heavy showers. Highest temperatures 7 to 9 degrees. And there's a warning of south to southeasterly gales or strong gales early tonight on all Irish coastal waters and on the Irish Sea. And that's all for now. News again at 11, but now back to the late debate.
Eileen, thank you very much indeed. You're welcome back to the programme. Later tonight, we'll be discussing if we are on the verge of another property boom. First, though, to the continuing controversy involving the Gardaí, Alan Shatter, and the Garda whistleblower, Sergeant Maurice McCabe. Joining me for this part of the discussion are Labour TD Dominic Hannigan, Sinn Féin TD Jonathan O'Brien, and Pat Leahy, political editor with the Sunday Business Post. Independent TD Mick Wallace had agreed to take part tonight, but he cancelled a little earlier. Alan Shatter got to his feet in the Dáil just after 10 o'clock this morning and spoke about the dossier of cases alleging Garda malpractice given to the Taoiseach by the Fianna Fáil leader last week. Minister Shatter detailed how the cases were fully investigated in 2009.
In relation to the allegations Deputy Martin made in the House last Thursday, in which he has repeated every opportunity both inside and outside the House since then, I want to deal first of all with the entirely incorrect assertion that nothing had been done in relation to a series of serious allegations involving alleged Garda misbehaviour. In 2008, Sergeant McCabe made a written complaint to Garda headquarters alleging neglect of duty and other malpractice by Garda at Bailyborough Garda station and failure by the superintendent to respond properly when Sergeant McCabe had brought these concerns to his attention. Sergeant McCabe also claimed he'd been victimised. Chief Superintendent was appointed to investigate these allegations. Later in 2008, the then Garda Commissioner received an anonymised complaint, which turned out to be from Sergeant McCabe, from the then Garda confidential recipient, Brian McCarthy, making allegations in relation to malpractice at Bailyborough Garda station and in relation to the failure of senior Garda at the station to respond to these concerns when they had been brought to their attention. An assistant commissioner was appointed to investigate these allegations. The investigation by the assistant commissioner over a lengthy period culminated in the submission of 10 volumes of evidence to the Director of Public Prosecutions, who of course independently directed that no prosecutions were warranted. The investigation did result in disciplinary action against a number of Gardaí.
Minister Shatter categorically denied that he had misled the Dáil last October when he said that the whistleblower, Sergeant Maurice McCabe, didn't cooperate with the investigation into the abuse of the penalty point system. He said that his own office had invited the whistleblower to talk to Assistant Commissioner John O'Mahony, who was leading the inquiry.
I absolutely accept that Sergeant Maurice McCabe was not interviewed by either Assistant Commissioner O'Mahony or the group, the team he had dealing with the issue. I said in the House that I expected that Sergeant McCabe would be engaged with the investigation and I expected that he would be interviewed. And I also made reference to a matter that different members of this House are taking a different view of. In the context of the, what's referred to as the direction, he clearly wasn't directed to engage, but he was invited to engage with Assistant Commissioner O'Mahony. In a letter from one of my departmental officials, which I can quote to the Deputy. In a letter from one of my departmental officials, he was asked to cooperate. This is a member of Ungava Seachorner, who knows an investigation is taking place on an issue of great concern to him. I conclude by saying that I said today different people have different perceptions of this issue.
Well, this evening, independent TD Roisin Shortall referred to comments made by the Garda Commissioner Martin Callanan at the Public Accounts Committee earlier this year, in which he described the actions of the whistleblowers as disgusting. She asked Minister Shatter if he distanced himself from such comments.
I want to raise two issues with the Minister. The first one is in relation to the Garda Commissioner's appearance before the Public Accounts Committee recently, where he described the actions of the two whistleblowers, Sergeant McCabe and former Garda John Wilson, as disgusting. Now, Minister, I'd like to ask you, what's your view of that comment? Do you agree with it? If you don't, are you prepared to take this opportunity to disassociate yourself from that assessment of the two Gardaí? And do you accept that kind of comment only serves to silence people who have the courage to speak up about things that are wrong, and that that kind of comment is entirely unhelpful if we're trying to create an atmosphere where whistleblowers can feel that they can come forward?
In relation to the first matter, I wasn't present at the Public Accounts Committee. I haven't read the transcript. I don't know the context of the comment made by the Commissioner. I am conscious that there are serious issues that Sergeant McCabe raised in relation to the ticket charge issue. In a number of areas, he's been proved correct. In a number of areas, he's been proved incorrect. I also know that there's very serious allegations made. He suggested and alleged that a variety of members of An Garda Síochána are corrupt. There's been widespread outside this House currency given to these allegations. He has conducted himself in a manner that if any other member of the force had so behaved would give rise to uproar in this House. We now know that he secretly taped apparently a conversation with a senior officer, and a transcript of that has been published, so it was referenced today in the House. I would think that there are concerns in this area. Now, I'm sorry, Deputy, if my answers don't suit, but this is a very complicated issue, because if 13,000 members of An Garda Síochána were engaged in the unauthorised taping of conversations, we would be asking GSOC to investigate the entire force.
Minister,
Minister, I asked you a straightforward question. Do you agree with the Garda Commissioner's assessment of the actions of the two whistleblowers or not? And if you don't, will you take this opportunity to disassociate yourself from that comment? And surely you accept that the whole issue of workplace bullying is a serious issue in our society. And the message needs to go out to people that they are encouraged to come forward, not encouraged to, or threatened in a way that ensures that they shut up if they have something to say. So this is an important issue. It goes way beyond the Gardaí. And it's important that you as Minister state your position on this. Do you agree with what the Commissioner said or not?
I think, Deputy, it's very important, and I've said this before, and that's why this government is bringing forward the legislation that Deputy Howland has, that whistleblowers are encouraged and they're protected. But I also think, I also believe that it's important that those who make allegations have the evidence to substantiate the allegations, and that they don't make allegations that are unsubstantiated. Now, and that they behave lawfully.
And that was the Minister, Alan Shatter, in an exchange with Independent TD Roisin Shortall. Dominic Hannigan of Labour, listening there to your former party colleague Roisin Shortall, were you happy with Alan Shatter's statement and comments today?
I thought Minister Shatter provided a very robust explanation of the situation. I thought it was very detailed. It was comprehensive in his approach. He took the unusual step of not just making a statement and listening to responses from members of the opposition, but of engaging in a question and answer session. And that gave deputies from both sides of the House the opportunity to raise a series of questions with him. So I think he provided a very detailed, comprehensive assessment of what he sees the current situations. And of course, he outlined exactly how he sees things moving on from here in terms of the inquiries that he has recently announced.
Do you believe him over Sergeant Maurice McCabe in relation to the failure or non-failure to participate with John O'Mahony's inquiry?
Look, it's a very complex situation. There's no doubt about that. From talking to people who live in my constituency, I know how detailed this is. I know it goes over the head of a lot of people. I have to tell you, I haven't studied in detail the all of the transcripts in relation to this. So I'm very happy to wait and to allow the independent assessors to look through the evidence. All of the evidence will be made available to them, and for them to come to a conclusion. As Minister Shatter outlined yesterday, there will be an opportunity to debate in the House in 6-8 weeks' time when Mr. Guerin's report is available. There'll be an opportunity then to debate, and at that stage I think it'll be clear.
But I'm not sure if this particular point is going to be included in Sean Guerin's. I don't think so. I mean, I don't think Sean Guerin is going to investigate whether or not Sergeant Maurice McCabe was directed or not to appear before John O'Mahony's inquiry.
Well, in terms of what the minister said today, and I just can refer back to the speech that he gave in the House earlier, for which I was present. He does say quite categorically that an official from his department advised Sergeant McCabe that any further information which might be helpful to the investigation should be brought forward. Not maybe brought forward, but should be brought forward. Presumably that letter will be made available to Mr. Guerin.
So in your mind, is that Sergeant Maurice McCabe being invited to attend John O'Mahony's investigation into the very issues that Maurice McCabe raised?
Minister Shatter today referred to a number of documents between his officials in his department and Sergeant McCabe.
But we haven't seen them.
No, we haven't seen them.
We don't know what they contain.
But he was very clear that those documents will be provided to Mr. Guerin. So I would expect that Mr. Guerin will have the opportunity to go through those documents in detail, to understand exactly what they mean and to make his own assumption and conclusion, which will then be provided to the House. I'm very happy to wait and see and to allow Mr. Guerin to carry out his study.
But do you think Alan Shatter has nothing to apologise to Maurice McCabe in the Dáil for?
At this stage, I think that's premature to make that decision. It's quite clear that there are a range of opinions out here from both sides of the argument. And I think that we should let Mr. Guerin carry out his work. We should let this inquiry take its course.
But listening to Alan
Shatter
answering
where the truth lies.
Listening to him answering Roisin Shortall's question there in that clip, it could be said that it was further undermining Maurice McCabe, the way he answered her question in relation to him.
You know, I wouldn't see that. I don't think that was the case. Personally, from my understanding of it and from listening to the evidence so far, I think that Minister Shatter has followed procedures to a large degree. It's quite clear that there are issues here raised by Micheál Martin last week for the first time by him that we need to get to the bottom of. The important thing here is that the Irish people have got confidence, not just in GSOC, not just in Garda Síochána, but also in our ministers and
in our
government.
I would suggest to you that after the last couple of weeks,
from these inquiries,
public confidence has been shattered. Not to use a terrible pun, but has been shattered in the Gardaí and in GSOC and whatever. And people are wondering, why is Labour not shouting from the rooftops about this? If you were in opposition, you would be.
For a start, I public confidence is certainly is I think what's fair to say is I wouldn't accept that public confidence is shattered. I think people recognise out there the very valuable work that Aon Gairdí Síochána do. They're the ones that turn up at road traffic accidents. They're the ones that have to turn up if there's a domestic incident in people's houses. And Aon Gairdí Síochána, by the way, are respected the world over. We give training, we give help throughout Europe and abroad. So I think we have to remember the good and the value that Aon Gairdí Síochána represent in our society. There are issues that have arisen in the last few months that we do need to get to the bottom of, because it's vitally important that we do restore confidence and trust. And you're right, confidence and trust has been impacted by recent events. I don't accept that confidence has been shattered. I don't accept that. I don't think it's like that. But I do agree with you that we do need to get to the bottom of this soon. We need to understand exactly what's going on, and we need to learn lessons and implement them, because at the moment there is a concern out there and we do need to address it. On behalf of my party, we're absolutely, can I say a few things? Firstly, we're absolutely convinced that we can improve the situation. Secondly, we have got total support for our members of the Gairdí Síochána doing a very, very difficult job out there. I think it's very important to remember that. We need to make sure that we rebuild the trust that has disappeared over the last few weeks. And I think that's something that we will be continuing to do over the coming
Jonathan O'Brien of Sinn Féin, after today, isn't it fair to say that the opposition failed to land the killer blow or ask the killer question of Alan Shatter? He is not going anywhere.
I think Alan Shatter, in his 30-minute speech today, there were two glaring omissions from the speech which he didn't address. The first one was the sacking of the confidential recipient. We were given no reasoning behind his removal from the post, and we have to take that into the context of when he was appointed. The minister himself said he was a very honourable man, that he was skilled in the art of mediation, and that he was the best person for the job. And yet we have had no reason from Minister Shatter why he took the decision.
Well, he did answer it in questions later on in the day. It wasn't part of his speech, but he did answer a question on it later on in the day.
And the Taoiseach briefly referred to it during leaders' questions when he said that the confidential recipient didn't deny the content of the transcripts and therefore he had to go. But I don't think he answered that comprehensively enough. The second issue was the whole area of Sergeant McCabe and the apology, which I think everyone was expecting Minister Shatter to make today, and it wasn't forthcoming. And I think those were two very glaring omissions. Now, Minister Shatter will say that Sergeant McCabe was invited to give evidence to the investigating team. But I think if you look at it from the other way around, if there's an allegation made of a crime being committed in relation to the penalty points debacle, and there's an assistant commissioner set up to look into it, and he has a team of 28 people, it is quite incredible that the assistant commissioner and his team didn't interview or didn't have any a face-to-face meeting with the very person who made the allegation in the first place. That is quite incredible when you think of it. It's even more incredible when you consider that they actually went and visited the station that Sergeant McCabe was based in
And Fianna Fáil and everyone on the opposition benches have been making those points now for the last number of days. But the point remains, Alan Shatter, on the basis of today's performance, I mean, he's no intention of resigning. There's absolutely no pressure on him to resign. This is all going away for the time being until Sean Gearan completes his inquiry.
Well, it's not a case of looking for Minister Shatter's head on a plate. This is about getting the truth. And the only way that can be achieved, in our opinion, is by the establishment of a commission of investigation under the 2004 legislation. That is the only way we can answer these questions, whether it's in relation to GSOC, alleged bugging of GSOC, whether it's in relation to the sacking of a confidential recipient or the penalty points debacle. Mm. The only way we can get to the truth, in my opinion and in my party's opinion, is by the establishment of a commission of investigation.
Okay, Pat Leahy. Pat, you're welcome to the programme. How would you assess Alan Shatter's performance today?
Well, I thought it was typically combative, as we've come to expect from Alan Shatter, but getting away from the style and trying to look at the substance of it, I think Alan Shatter is retreating. It's just, it's not so obvious because it's been happening slowly over the last couple of weeks, and it's been happening under the cover of a lot of political smoke, as it were, not to get too martial in the metaphors. I think on three substantial issues, on the bugging, on the penalty points, and on the McCabe dossier, the minister's first reaction was to say there's nothing to see here. This has been investigated appropriately and by the appropriate authorities. Nothing has been found. It's time for everybody to move on. Mm-hmm. And in each of those three substantive issues, the government has conceded independent inquiries of one form or another. So it's quite clear that that Minister Shatter has moved.
But are they just not diversionary tactics almost to keep everyone else quiet for a while?
But all they do is keep people quiet for a while. I mean, two of the inquiries, the Geeran inquiry and to decide whether a formal commission of inquiry is to be set up, and the review of documents being undertaken by the judge, Judge John Cook, those are to return with their reports to government in fairly short order, both of them before Easter, I think. So to the extent that, you know, this thing may die down, and it's been one of the features of this controversy over the last 3 weeks, and this is the third week that it has, seems to me, almost paralysed the workings of government. One of the features of it is that every couple of days somebody says, oh, well, it's going to die down now. And it hasn't. Now, maybe this time is different. Maybe it will die down now. But even if it does, in a best case scenario for Minister Shatter and for the government, it's going to flare up again in 6 or 8 weeks' time. So I don't think it's gone away.
Dominic Hannigan, on this programme last night we had a discussion, and the view was from Solicitor Frank Buttermer and Jim Cusack, security journalist, that there was a really widespread, serious, systemic problem within An Garda Síochána Síochána. Do you accept that? Do you accept that that is feasible?
I think it's clear from the last couple of months that there are issues in relation to how people can raise their perceived problems within the force. Clearly the allegations that were made, there is doubt as to whether they were investigated fully, and hence the most recent inquiries. That's why I welcome the announcement yesterday that there will be a change to the legislation in relation to whistleblowers from the Gardaí. I think we need to look, and it's been suggested by some people, we need to look more at a situation like they have perhaps in the north of Ireland, where we've got an independent authority with responsibility over the Gardaí. At the moment, the Gardaí are responsible to the Dáil via the minister. Perhaps we should be looking at putting in place an independent body, because it's in everybody's interest that we have a first-rate Garda Síochána force. I think they do an excellent job, but I do think there's room for improvement. I don't think anybody can doubt that.
There's no government proposals on anything like that, nor is there likely to be.
Well, Pat, it's something that we are discussing at the moment, not in government, but certainly our party is looking at things.
You're discussing it outside government.
I can't say what our coalition partners are doing, but there's discussions within our party whether or not they lead to any definite recommendations in terms of legislation.
It's not in the programme for government.
It's too early to say. It's not in the programme for government, but it's certainly something that we are looking at. We have to learn lessons from the situation that has arisen over the last few months. We have to try to improve the situation, and that's through legislation. That's what politics is all about. So you're right, it's not in the current programme of government, but it's certainly something that we're looking at.
And in his statement today, which you said you were happy with at the outset of the programme, Alan Shatter kept referring back to the numerous investigations by the Gardaí themselves, then the DPP and GSOC into this dossier. Are you happy that those investigations were sufficient? Or were the investigative processes, by their very nature and with regard to the system that's there in place at the moment, are too weak?
I would hope that the inquiries that are currently underway, particularly Mr. Geeran's inquiry, will address that very question. If there are weaknesses in the current way that that complaints are assessed, then we need to learn from that, we need to address that, and we need to rectify the situation. I think the jury is out yet. I think we need to see the report, we need to see Mr Guerin's findings in relation to this.
But listening to Alan Shatter today, he didn't point up any of the weaknesses in the investigative process. He was setting his stock by these investigations that had already happened.
And I think what we would all hope is that the report from Mr Guerin will identify weaknesses as he sees them there. If there are weaknesses, I'm sure he will point them out. And what we have to do is make sure that we fill these weaknesses. It's in everybody's interest, not just the citizen in terms of restoring faith and trust in the Gardaí. It's in the Gardaí Shia Conas' interest themselves. The average member in the force is fed up with what's going on at the moment. They see themselves being undermined.
By their own leaders.
They see themselves undermined by the process and by the situation that we're in. And I think it's in their interest as much as it's in society's interest that we make sure that if there are gaps, if there are weaknesses, that we fix those gaps and rectify them. And that's our job as legislators to introduce and to fix and to amend laws.
Okay. And Jonathan O'Brien, it looks like this is heading towards a commission of inquiry. I think Agriculture Minister Simon Coveney said as much today on News Talk.
But the fact remains that we are not at that position yet. And I mean, this has dominated the political agenda for the last 3 weeks. And the government could have easily taken it out of the political arena by establishing a commission of investigation under the 2004 Act. It has failed to do so. What it has done now in relation to the GSOC is Judge Cook, and in relation to the second of the confidential recipient, the senior counsel Sean Guerin, is going to look at all of the documentation in relation to that. But ultimately, Pat is right, it's going to come back into the political arena again, whether it's 6 or 8 weeks' time, and it's going to flare up again. And I think that was a huge mistake on behalf of the government. We are talking about some serious allegations that go to the very heart of the administration of justice within this state. Now, if that is not a serious enough issue to establish a commission of investigation under the legislation, then what is? What is? And the question that also is being asked is, who is afraid of what the findings of any commission of investigation will establish? The advantages of the commission of investigation, and with all due respect to Judge Cook and to Senior Counsel Sean Guerin, what has been proposed is simply not good enough. It's just simply not good enough. What we need is a commission of investigation that has the power to compel witnesses, to take statements, and to make findings of fact. And that is what is needed. And that is, it shouldn't be a case of that's where we may or may not be heading. That is where we should be in this present circumstance.
Fine word from you, Pat. And I suppose a lot of criticism from various quarters directed towards Labour. And some people saying, you know, that Labour are happy for Minister Shatter to remain in the Cabinet because he's the most liberal member of the Cabinet.
No, that, to be fair, sorry, Pat, but that's a load of cobblers. Like, that's not the case at all. We believe that Minister Shatter, and I know Pat is trying to get in here, we believe that Minister Shatter should be assessed on the basis of his performance. We're very willing to wait for the outcome of the Cook inquiry and the Guerin inquiry. It's nothing to do with whether or not we see him as an ally. If the man is right for the job, he should stay in the job. If he's not, he should be out. Simple as that. Sorry, Pat.
Yeah, Labour does see him as an ally and would not be displeased to have him there on that basis into the future. There is no one view of this in Labour. I spoke to people over the last couple of days who were deeply nervous about where it was going, about the direction of play in it. But again, I spoke to other people near the top of the Labour Party who were more of the view that Dominic is of. That is, if an investigation is needed, then so be it. They seemed to me, given the extent to which the government's agenda has been dominated by this over the past 3 weeks, they seemed to me to be intensely relaxed about it, more so than I would be, I would have said.
Okay, thank you all very much indeed. Pat and Jonathan, you're leaving us at this point. Thank you very much indeed for joining us to discuss the latest in that ongoing controversy. We're going to stay, Dominic is staying with us, and we're joined at this point by Dr. Mary Murphy, lecturer in sociology at NUI Maynooth and acting chairwoman of of the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. And also joining us for this part of our discussion, Carl Dieter, financial advisor and analyst at Irish Mortgage Brokers and Advisors.ie. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. Well, here's a question. Are we on the cusp of another property bubble? Reading some of the newspaper stories over the past few weeks and months, you might come to the conclusion that we are. Property prices in Dublin are pushing upwards nearly 4% in the last 3 months of 2013, nearly 16% higher than the same period in 2012. Sales are up too, and demand for housing is rising. Carl, what's your view on that question? Are we on the cusp of another property boom, property bubble?
I think that some of the key ingredients to really get into the manic phase aren't there, but we're doing everything right to lay the foundations of it. Some of the historical research I'm working on at the moment with a guy named Frank Quinn is to trace our property booms and busts going back 300 years, because we didn't always have credit which made bubbles, but we still had this kind of huge fluctuations in price and transactions. And it's important to remember that scarcity is one of the things that drives it. And when you don't have a large supply and people feel that there is scarcity in the market and the prices start to rise, that creates the confidence that drives more resources into it. Now, in the past, sometimes scarcity, it's important to remember, was expressed as overcrowding. So it wasn't always a case of ghost estates or that. That's more of a modern part of property cycle phenomenon. But by ensuring that the credit cycle is not alive and well, it means that you don't have, for instance, the lending out there to allow the development. I'm not talking about just using mortgages to buy houses. You've got to ensure that the land is being used. Mm-hmm. But of the 30,000 planning permissions around Dublin, most of them are deeply insolvent. And the idea of taxing those sites, while I agree with it in theory, might not resolve that situation, because it doesn't mean the people are now in a position to develop. The idea of having an annual local property tax, but at the same time having development levies, which are upfront contributions, which developers have to pay, as well as Part 5, which is part of the Planning Act, where they have to put money across for social housing, makes it very expensive to break ground. So we're doing all these things that will actually create a limitation to the supply. Then there's a deeper push for the type of supply that people don't want. Everyone is saying you need high density, but Irish people overwhelmingly choose to live in lower density. We have the highest in all the Eurostat area ownership of detached and semi-detached homes. You've got things like tracker mortgages, where people are staying put. They don't want to move because of a financial product associated with the house. You've got negative equity. So when you compound all these things together, what happens is you basically get a housing cycle where nothing's happening. And yet in people's normal lives, they're still meeting people, falling in love, having kids, forming households. In Dublin City alone, for instance, there's more than 200 households form every week. Mm-hmm. And yet there's not 200 houses being built. So it creates pent-up demand. You see it in the rental market. It's up 47% between the last two censuses. That creates that push. Now that push is currently underway. Can we get the supply to match that demand? I don't think so. And when the credit cycle turns, as it will, credit and property are not the same cycle, when the two of them become a little more aligned, that's when it gets very scary.
Mary Murphy. Mary, you're welcome to the programme. What's your answer to that question? Do you think we're on the cusp?
Well, I think, as Carl said, there's a number of things going on, and it is very complicated and complex to work out. But I think two things are of particular concern to me. One is that we came from a background where there was a very unbalanced economy, a very unsustainable economy, where far too much of our potential for investment was put into unproductive spheres like finance and construction. And really what we need to be doing is making sure that whatever way we move forward with the economy, that we're providing vehicles so that people who have credit, who have monies to invest, can invest in productive parts of the economy as well as in construction and finance. So we need to have some investment vehicles for things like small and medium enterprise, social economies, cooperatives and other forms of job creation that aren't just about the construction industry. Otherwise, we create that big structural imbalance in the economy again. I think the other thing that worries me is there's a building up of demand and pressure around housing demand. That's not the exact same thing as housing need. Mm-hmm. And my fear would be that the construction industry are building up a very strong case. Carl just mentioned their demand to change Part 5 of the Development Act, demand to take away development levies. And we see a picture developing here where there's a certain lobby building up to create a housing market that won't necessarily meet some of the really pressing demand or the really pressing need that's there, particularly at the lower end of the market. And I would be very worried at the moment in terms of the lobbying that's going on, that there is pressure on government to begin to release things like the Part 5 obligation to build 20% social and affordable housing. And if anything, what we really need to do is reinforce Part 5 and really make the whatever increase in building comes about over the next cycle, that a very significant part of that building is social housing. Part 5 is one way of delivering that. State investment in social housing is another way of delivering it. And obviously social housing through housing associations and the like. But there is a real need at the bottom end that isn't the same as meeting housing demand or addressing a housing bubble.
There's a lot to be said for that. And I can't disagree when we talk about things like, you know, housing for low income. The question is, does Part 5 resolve that, and does development levies fix that problem? Because that problem existed while both of these things existed. So one is not a cure for the other. It's a compelling social argument, but in practice, it doesn't actually make any difference. The real point is, you know, the government don't do a good job of providing housing. If they did, there wouldn't be nearly 100,000 people on the housing list, and you wouldn't have the private rented sector coming in to fill that gap if they were able to do that job. So look at their track record. It's not up to scratch. That's not down to particular parties. Everyone is in the same boat. And internationally, almost every country is in the same boat. So it is going to have to, unfortunately, be a private sector response. Now, is the answer, therefore, to create situations with stymie supply? Because if you stymie supply, whatever about the low-end houses not being built, the middle range and top-end houses also don't get built, you still get that increase in price. It still feeds into speculation. And again, this happened long before we had planning, long before any of these modern institutions existed. These cycles have been around for a very long time, and the argument in them is highly compelling. The trick is to get across the curve and to get ahead of the curve. And whatever it takes to get supply, that's probably closer to a resolution than any of the high moral foundation ideas we might discuss here. Mm-hmm. Because the truth is, out of anyone sitting here, I don't know, do you build houses? You know, I've built houses, but I can tell you it's not simple.
In most countries in the world, the state plays a fairly significant role in addressing housing needs, particularly at the lower end of the market. And just because they didn't do it over the last two decades, or they did it badly over the last two decades, certainly they took their foot off the accelerator in relation to building social housing directly. Certainly they didn't use vehicles like Part 5. They let that come out through affordable housing rather than through social housing. But that doesn't mean that you can leave meeting people's housing needs to the market. Absolutely not.
But you're absolutely,
the state has to have a role in addressing this housing need.
You're absolutely correct. However, we're 100,000 behind already. Okay, and this is a fact. You see, numbers still matter. And the numbers in this don't stack up to saying that Part 5 fixes this. So what they're saying is, we have this idea that we should do this social housing thing. Great. We should be doing X, Y, Z. Great. Part 5 that's not going to be brought in from developments that won't happen is about as much use to you as warming yourself on a fire in China when you're sitting here in Ireland. It's just not going to make any difference.
Part 5 is one vehicle, but the real issue, I think, is the state directly building social housing and more effective funding vehicles for social housing projects to build social housing. These houses need to be built. There's no other solution to meeting people's housing needs other than houses. And clearly we'll see that the market will not deliver these houses.
Yeah. Dominic,
just going, thanks, Audrey. Just going back to your initial question, I don't believe we're in the same situation as we were back at the beginning of the last decade. The reasons for the boom were due to the access to credit, as well as Ireland saw an influx of several hundred thousand people in the first few years of the last decade because of the increase in enlargement in the European Union. So demand went up as well as access to credit. Where we are today is we don't have the same access to credit. Indeed, the only people who are currently buying properties in Dublin, where the boom seems to be, are people with cash. Now, the impact of that, of course, it means that there are many people out there who have, like Carl said, recently set up relationships, who are interested in buying but can't because they can't get access to credit. And of course, that means that they then enter the rental market, and the rental market's gone up. It's a real problem for us. And as Mary has said, we're not doing enough in terms of housing. I think it's something that we appreciate. There are currently, we're building several thousand social houses every year. Part 5 is part of a solution, but certainly it's not going to be the thing that delivers 100,000 houses every year. So we do need to act on this. It's something that we as a party are very aware of. It's something that we do want to see some change on. As you know, we're limited in terms of the amount of money we can spend on capital expenditure, but it's something that we do need to look at, whether it's through PPPs, whether it's to look at through social bonds or whatever. Mm. We do need to try to bridge the gap between the demand out there for social housing and the current delivery of units, because we are far short of what we need to do.
I think the important thing on the taxation of it is that any taxation that occurs which drives up prices is fundamentally negative. Because the people who buy houses, or even the people who need them for social housing, because again, don't forget, it can express itself as scarcity, and I think that that's really what's happening in the social housing area, they're the ones who pay the cost. So, you know, all of these things just drive up prices. So, like, say if a litre of petrol is €1.55, about 10% of that is the actual cost of the fuel. Everything else is tax. And when you make an embedded cost, you embed something into that that can't be avoided. And even VAT, any of these things, they all rest with the end user. You know, the businesses that make the house, they all offset VAT against each other. The end user gets hit with the full amount. The end user ultimately gets hit with the Part 5. The end user ultimately gets hit with all of the contributions. Is it the end user who should be the one paying for this? Or should we be instead putting some part of general taxation aside to build these houses?
And people don't use houses. They live in homes. And I really think we need to take the market out of this to some degree. The Constitutional Convention last weekend talked about putting a greater range of rights into our constitution. And one of them that was discussed a lot was the right to a home. Mm-hmm. Because I do think that we need to look at what people need, not addressing the needs of the construction industry, and get back to basics about what people really want. And what they want is security. They want to know that they can afford the home that they're living in. We need to take the emphasis off people's need for a home can only be addressed through the market. Yeah. I think a better regulated general supply of housing, some of it owned by people, but much of it rented by people, in a better regulated rental market will get us much nearer to meeting people's real need for secure homes that they can rely on having for a long time and that meet their needs over their life cycle.
Do you agree, Carl?
Not really. I mean, when they talk about the Constitutional Convention, I don't even follow politics, so I'm not sure what that is, but saying that, you know, a home should be a right, that's kind of hippie bullshit, because the fact of the matter is that a home, if it's a right, if a right comes with a corresponding cost, then someone somewhere has to pay for it. And that's really what we need to get down to, is how do you meet that cost to deliver what people require, to have safe housing that is of a good standard, that is durable, built to last, and close to amenities. And the state has never solved that. The state in any country has never solved that. So to say take the market out of it is basically saying kill off the only part of it that actually does work.
It's about the balance between the market and the state, I think. And I think as Carl's describing it, he's assuming that there's no state at all there to regulate a market. You can't have a solely market-driven focus to delivering housing needs.
Well, the regulation of the property market, may I add, by the way, is amongst the worst. This, despite everything that happened and the idea that it was all finance-led only and we need to regulate for finance, the actual regulation within the property market is still deplorable. It is still a totally opaque, shallow trench that has terrible practice riddled throughout it. So, you know, if we want to talk about the regulation, again, I'm in favor of that. Mm. But the solutions for it still come down to this. You cannot take out the one functioning part of this market, which is standard private built housing, and say that isn't really the answer, because it's the one thing that has proven the test of the market and nothing else has.
But to be balanced, nobody is talking about taking out the building of private homes and the selling of private homes. What we're talking about is trying to get a better balance between the various types of housing provision that are necessary to meet housing need. It was ironic, but on the 6 o'clock news this evening, apart from the GSOC and all the other controversy that was on, three of the lead items related to people's housing problems. There was the Irish nationwide securitisation of mortgages, there was the pyrite issue, and there was the issue of addressing flooding damage. And like, these issues are so close to people's heart, and there needs to be a much better regulatory framework. I'm sorry, but people do need to have a stronger sense that their homes are secure and that these needs are addressed and not left to the vagaries of the private market to deliver them.
And the outcome of the pirate issue is an example of how government, when it gets its act together, can actually deliver real improvements to people's lives, because the pirate problem affects up to 10,000 homes. We're aware of 1,000 that will need remediation. We've now put in place a scheme whereby people who are suffering from pyrite can go through the process of actually getting their houses fixed. But coming back to the issue about, and I know the Constitutional Convention discussed, you know, the issue about the right to a home. Let's be clear here. Irish society provides everybody with a roof over their heads in some form or another. The question is, how do we do that as efficiently and as effectively as possible as a state? Now, currently, in my view, there's far too much people reliant on the private rental market. What we need to do as a society and as a government is provide more social housing to ensure that we provide these services effectively, we give people the security that they require in the comfort that they deserve.
That's true. But you see, again, I suppose I struggle when I talk to someone who's in politics because all those things are true. But you see, then we have to put numbers on it because that's what the actual world operates on. It's like talking about cars should have all these features, but you still got to fuel it. You know, where does that happen? How does it happen? I agree we should have more social housing. I think that the amount of rent allowance and the number of people reliant on it is a drag on the economy. Mm-hmm. I think that by and large, a lot of landlords don't want people who receive rent allowance. Mm-hmm. And that in turn actually excludes a lot of people from the market. And when you have fluctuations in rental prices, it gives them uncertainty in their tenure because they can either then push on a landlord to say, I want you to chop the rent down, and the landlord suffers financially, might decide to sell, that wrecks their tenure, or the landlord pushes it up, as we saw recently, and you've got people effectively being evicted by rising prices. Mm-hmm. So those are all things, that they're all real things with real people on the end of it. But that statement is that's all it is. It's just a statement of ideals. But how do we get from where we are now to there? And that's the thing.
Just to answer that question, one problem that we've got at the moment, in my view, and it was a problem of policy of the previous government, was they brought in a situation where private landlords were guaranteed a rent over up to 20 years for renting their houses out to public sector, to people on the social housing list. Now, Carl, it would have been a lot more economically effective, a better cost-benefit result for the government if we'd actually built the houses, because in 20 years' time, we'd own them, not some private sector landlord. Yeah. So there are policy decisions that we can take as a government that can lead to better decisions and better results for society on the whole. That's what we need to do. That's the type of thing we should be looking at.
You do lay off your risk when you get someone else to do it.
You do.
And then you don't have to come up with the upfront capital because we were busy spending on other things. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the deterioration, the ongoing maintenance. So I'll be honest with you, that argument, when you actually sit down and do your spreadsheet on it, doesn't necessarily stack up.
I'm not sure about that. Having looked at the spreadsheets, I'm not sure what I agree with.
Well, if you look at some of the spreadsheets that are done at a European level when you're looking at cost-benefit analysis in relation to state investment in housing vis-a-vis what they save for having solved problems that would otherwise happen. So if you don't invest in social housing, you run much greater risk of things like homelessness. Mm-hmm. The costs of dealing with things like homelessness are absolutely phenomenal. They're very, very high. So there's Dutch data, for example, that shows that for every euro that the state invested in social housing, it managed to save twice that at the other end in terms of the kind of issues they avoided. There's Austrian data that shows even more. If you put money into preventative services that stop people being evicted, if you put in successful mediation services, for example, for landlord and tenants, you invest very little in the preventative stage and you save a hell of a lot in having to rehouse people who have been made homeless and have had to go through emergency accommodation. So the numbers do stack up that if you do invest early and you build the houses and you give people an adequate legal framework to have their housing need protected, you do actually save the state some significant monies in the longer term. I think that's important.
The last Dublin City Council budget, as I recall, I think the emergency housing and associated services was about 38 million euro for the year. Now, I'd have to double check to make sure. I'm pretty sure that's the figure, though. Now, I don't know how many houses you'd build for that 38 million or if the people who became homeless wouldn't be dealing with those services anyway, because addiction is tied to a lot of it. One of the things, though, in terms of breaking down the barriers to allow people the chance to have their homes, you know, everything that we do, if you look at some of the news, is about actually preventing construction. So you even see it with pylons, people saying, not in my backyard. Well, in Germany, you've got the right to build, and they don't seem to have the same issue of everything like, you know, sudden scarcity of development land occurring the way that we do. Because this is the fact, the planners control the availability of development land, and in turn, they create the scarcity that delivers windfall gains to other people. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is so categorically wrong. I think it should be a case that the planners are given a target, that if house prices inflate over a certain amount, then much like the ECB, they're not doing their job. They should be on the chopping block. We shouldn't have house price inflation in double-digit numbers. And I think that if the state wants to say you can't build on that land, well, then let the state freaking buy the land and they can do something with it.
We don't have house price inflation in double digits outside Dublin. There is an issue in Dublin and I suppose...
This cycle, like I said, is 300 years old. Well, you know, it's been going for a long time. In terms
of the availability of development land outside the capital, and I know from my own county of Meath, you know, there are still vast tracts of land zoned for residential purposes. Now, local authorities throughout the country have tried to make sure that the release of that land is done in an ordered fashion so that when it's released, you've got your shops, you've got your schools there, so that people aren't just living in a residential wasteland. The planners have to make sure that any development that is delivered is good, positive development and provides for integrated communities. So they can't just release land like that because of some perceived demand. They do it in an ordered fashion. And on the whole, I think we've learned a lot of lessons over the craziness of 15 years ago in terms of the land development, because and we're still in some parts of the country we're still dealing with the mess of the development that happened 15 years ago.
I suppose one of the lessons that we learned a lot longer than 15 years ago was the Kenny report in terms of the possibilities we had in relation to actually managing the development land, and the idea that, you know, you couldn't make more than the basic agriculture price plus a certain amount, like 20% or whatever. That's still there to be implemented if we chose to do it. There's lots of things that we could implement if we chose to do it. I think the other area that there's increasing pressing demand, and we'll see it particularly in relation to people's capacity to move into employment as jobs hopefully do become available, and that's in relation to the need to reform the whole area of rent allowance, the rent supplements that people get when they're on social assistance payments. Now, there is supposed to be a move to have a housing assistance payment, but it looks as if that's going to take a very, very long time to come in. It's only been piloted across a number of local authority areas at the moment, but there will be a pressure point there, I think, whereby people will be in private rented housing, they will get relatively low paid jobs, and they'll find that they won't be able to move into those jobs because they will lose that kind of rent supplement. So we need to move much more swiftly to a situation that we can ease the transition for those people moving from welfare into particularly into relatively low paid jobs. I think that's an absolute priority, and I do think it's an area where I'd be concerned we're not seeing enough progress on.
Carl.
Yeah, where labour market activation meets the housing market, no matter where you go, it's something that's just, I don't know that anyone ever has the answers. I mean, it's important to remember as well, when you're talking about housing, no one actually knows everything. And that is just the fact. I spent my whole life studying this stuff, and I'm still a moron when it comes down to it, because there's like a million things that I'll never know and that I don't know. So trying to get it right, and certainly in the time that we have to discuss it, it's just never going to happen. But I don't want to keep banging on the same drum. Fundamentally, in an area where you have a high demand and a supply pinch, the solution has got to be to increase supply. Mm-hmm. It is just simple, common sense. And I don't know that we've really discussed a way to increase supply so far in this conversation.
It's difficult because if you look at, for instance, you talked about labour market activation. We've got instances in places like Kildare and some parts of South Meath at the moment where you see new multinationals coming in, setting up the Googles of the world, the Intels of the world, creating several hundred jobs, in some cases thousands of jobs, putting significant pressure on the local housing market.
Yeah, because all of a sudden people have Kerry Foods, Kildare, I think, are coming in as well.
People need to live somewhere. And to try to provide the houses and to meet that sudden demand is very, very difficult. If the supply isn't there.
I mean, you know, I think it's just fascinating. Like human evolution, the first bipedal hominids were 3 million years ago, roughly. We eventually came into the people that we are today. And in all that time, we've always had houses, caves, wattle and daub walls, all different things. And it's even with all the great science out there and the fact that we've been building houses ever since we were able to do anything almost, like it still takes longer to build a house than it does to put the beacon spaceship on Mars. You know, that's what the reality that you're dealing with. And the supply pinch that we have now, it's only going to build, because no matter what we do, even if they just said in the morning, the gates are open, build whatever you want, wherever you want, it's going to be 3 years down the road before a single door gets opened. Mm-hmm. And yet we're showing this now and we see it now. And again, nothing is being done right now to stop that situation from developing.
But Carl, there's more than one supply pinch. And what worries me about the line that you're taking is that all the energy of the construction industry and all the energy of the market and the property supplements and everything else will bubble up around addressing a particular supply problem for a particular income range in a particular location.
No, you see, I'm not trying to say
Dublin and particularly
to preclude anyone. And
no, I know that you're not trying to preclude everybody, but if you totally focus on a market-driven solution to housing supply, you will only address the supply for a certain range of income groups in a certain area.
A non-market
you have
solution.
To have a greater balance that includes addressing the supply pinch that's there at the much lower end in relation to social housing, and also addressing some of the issues in relation to private rental housing, where there's massive supply pinch, as you describe it, going on, but it's at the very lower end where people are effectively being made homeless now. Families on a monthly basis, in the multiples of families on a monthly basis, because of supply pinch at the lower end of the rental market. Now, to some degree, that's about easing supply up the line. I know that. But we need to make sure that we're balancing our housing response and policy across each of those areas, not just responding to the media driven kind of frenzy that will be there in meeting one particular type of supply.
I think two things is that the production of supply is not aimed at anyone, it's aimed at everybody. And by releasing more supply, it will actually naturally create more housing for all income levels, because no one is saying go out and build 5-bed semis in Mount Marion. The thing is, it has to be geographical and it has to be in Dublin, because if you want to talk about a solution not being geographical, then we already have a solution. Everyone who's poor, go and live in Leitrim. There's loads of houses and they're dead cheap. But that's not going to work either. So we've got to put the supply where people actually want it and in a timely manner.
And therefore, and it cannot be left up to the market itself. Therefore, the state has to take a much more directive role in ensuring that the houses are built where people need them and where jobs are near as well.
But that's just a total disconnect of logic, because the state can't do that job and is 100,000 behind already. So, like, that's
I'm not
that
suggesting
make any
that
sense.
The state build the houses. I'm suggesting that the state take a very proactive role in regulating.
Yeah, we could do
with
the housing policy.
The
you know, we could do a lot of
housing
things.
Housing policy, but transport policy,
supply,
planning policy, development policy.
Supply in Dublin, and it really the conversation doesn't need to go far beyond that. And how do you get there? And again, this is cyclical and circular, because every time I say it, we talk about ideals and where we should be, but no one so far has actually said how we do it.
Dominic?
Yeah, I think we need to see an improvement on the current situation. There's no doubt about that. We do need to address the deficit that's there. Dublin is a particular issue for us. I think we need to look up rather than out. I think that one of the problems that we have in this city is that we have historically been a low-rise, low-density city, unlike many of our competitors, any other European cities. That's made it difficult to provide good public transport links. That's one of the reasons why we have got no metro, is because we just don't have the density of population in our capital city. So I think we need to consider, and I know it's not a popular thing amongst many people to say, but I do think that we need to consider going up as opposed to just taking up more land around the M50. We need to think about higher densities in the city centres.
That's the kind of thing I'm looking to hear. But then you've got to bear in mind what's happening out on the street. So higher densities, city centres. People want to live close to cities, and the overwhelmingly known trend in the world since 2007, more than half the world's population has lived in cities. It's the first time in history that that happened. Cities are no longer a place to hide from the roaming hordes of the countryside. They're a place where business takes place. But the higher density isn't what people want. That's not what they're looking to buy, and it is definitely not the type of home of choice. More importantly, high-rise costs about 1,500 a square metre to build, because we got more reinforced steel bar and higher concrete pours, both expensive things to do and the kind of technology that goes with it, where standard housing is about 900 per meter to build. Now, going up is more costly, and it's also a type of stock that people don't want. Mm. So now, again, get back to squaring it to get that supply up in the place that people want it. When you're talking about building a supply that's more expensive of something that people don't want. But I do like the fact that we've actually come up with at least one idea.
I think people don't want the type of high density that they've seen built in this country. But I do think that there's a possibility that people would want to live in high density that is decent quality, much bigger size in terms of the scales of it, and comes with the kind of communal supports around it that enable people to live good quality lives in high density. I think part of the problem is our experience of high density in Ireland, particularly in the 1990s, was very, very poor, and people really got turned away from it. People go to flats and apartments all over Europe and love them. They think that they're great. And we did, I think, begin to build better high density towards the end of the Celtic Tiger era. And we can keep doing that and learning what's good high density and good planning with the proper infrastructure around it, like pocket parks and places for kids to play, drying areas.
That's actually, what it means. I think some of that might have some merit. I mean, if you look at the average apartment size matched to the average income, if you take the two things as being that like average people live in average housing, then people who talk about shoebox apartments in Ireland, that's actually more like the standard size in lots of parts of Europe. But what they do have in lots of parts of Europe is better amenities in the area so that you don't have to spend your whole house or your whole time in your house. And that doesn't have to become the castle that you can't go out and get somewhere else.
Yeah.
So I think that is something to look at, you know, try and find ways to reduce crime in more parts of the city that are currently derelict. Mm-hmm. I think that loosening up some of the restraint on buildings that are historic that might not be historic at all, because basically in 2000 they came by and they just said whole streets, that's all preserved. We're not going to look at any of the features or the fact that roof was put in 10 years ago. It's just the whole damn street is preserved. Those are also things that can do it.
Okay.
But
living over shop schemes. There is a lot that can be done. But
okay.
It's just incredibly complex.
We are out of time, but thank you all very much indeed for taking part in this discussion. Carl Dieter, Dr. Mary Murphy and Dominic Hannigan of Labour. Back at 10 tomorrow night. Till then, good night.
The Late Debate, presented by Audrey Carville, was produced by Donal O'Herlihy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney. The researcher, Richie Byrne. And sound supervision tonight was by Sarah May Leach.